The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Web Studio, Primetime Advertising Corporation, and the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but if God is really a just God, then why do we see so little justice in the world? That's a good question, an excellent question. Part of the answer is that God has given human beings a good deal of responsibility where justice is concerned. For one thing, he gives us a conscience. He's also spoken at various times in history, like the big time, the time when Moses met him at Mount Sinai, that Old Testament time. And in such times, God has shared his heart, God has shared his mind, God has shared his laws, and most human beings have wanted little to do with God. Let me put this as simply and as clearly, but I believe as accurately as I can. When I see evil in the world, it does not convince me that God doesn't exist. It convinces me instead that God knew just exactly what he was talking about when he gave his commandments. Our disobedience is what's ruining the world, not God. And since we as human beings are made in God's image, we too are supposed to administer justice. We're not merely to sit around and wait for God to do it. That means that when an evil man is apprehended, we act appropriately instead of acting politically correct. This is a lesson the Obama administration seems to be learning the hard way. It looks as if 9/11 mastermind Khalid Mohammed will not be tried in New York City after all. The uproar of public opinion finally has the ear of the White House. Still, one has to wonder why this man is being tried in any civilian court, regardless of the city. These are the kinds of questions that have been put forth to the Obama administration, questions that they haven't done a very good job of answering, I should say. In fact, they tend to dance around them. And what does dancing remind you of? That's right. It's time for another episode of Dancing to the Questions and Answers with Barack Obama.
Question me and answer bright and clear. I will answer with a question clear and bright. Even though your answer may be wrong, my question will be right. Question me and answer. Answer with a question. The year that Babe Ruth hit his 60th home run.
Wellington and Waterloo.
Who became the hero at the Battle of Bull Run? Learning can be lots of fun.
Attorney General Eric Holder defends the decision to try Khalid Mohammed by reminding us that we are a country of laws which must give people a fair trial. Then, to reassure those who believe we have too soft of an administration, Holder guarantees a guilty verdict. And yet somehow, if the verdict is innocent, even though we know it won't be, well, don't worry, we still won't let the man go. Okay, just for argument's sake, let's put aside the fact that Mohammed is not an American citizen and therefore not protected by our Constitution. We'll also ignore another minor little detail. The snake already confessed long ago. And finally, we'll overlook the military truth that this 9/11 architect has declared war on America, thus earning the status of enemy combatant. Now, then, forgetting all of that, let's just take Holder at his word. The man has been accused of a crime. We Americans cannot lower our standards by forgetting the rule of law. The man deserves a fair trial. Okay, fine. Fine, then, just a few simple questions. Why does Holder already know what the verdict will be if it's going to be a fair trial? And why does Holder promise that we will not release this man, regardless of the verdict, if it is going to be a fair trial? Folks, I'm telling you, Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland made more sense than the Obama administration. At least Alice, after having been exposed to a plethora of silly contradictions, finally woke up. But Khaled Mohammed's trial isn't the only example of Obama's brilliant judicial policies. No, Umar Abdulmutallab, also known as the Christmas Day bomber, was read some Miranda rights not long after his arrest. Sweet. Once he lawyered up, he stopped talking. The Obama administration, after being dragged through the ringer by public outcry, first claimed that the FBI got all the information they needed prior to the arrival of Perry Mason. Now they are bragging about how Abdulmutallab is voluntarily providing useful information again. Well, which is it? Did they get all the information they needed originally, or are they just getting it now? How often are we going to watch this administration contradict itself more often than a kid who denies stealing a cookie from the jar, only to later on admit that he did indeed eat one so that little brother wouldn't be tempted to disobey the same rule? Whatever info the FBI got or did not get, this terrorist is an enemy combatant who declared war on our country. Those trying to destroy our Constitution are not entitled to the rights of that same Constitution. Oh, well, in any event, amazing as it all sounds, I suppose the real unbelievable truth to swallow is that our politically correct government was willing to use the word Christmas in describing Abdulmutallab. How come they aren't calling him the holiday bomber? I guess when a negative memory is associated with an action, then the title Christmas works after all. Okay, let's add it all up. A terrorist tries to set off a bomb for reasons he considers holy. He makes the attempt on our own holy day, and when we watch our government's response, it leaves us saying, "Holy cow!" Don't worry, I won't let the phrase holy cow segue into Hinduism just because they think cows are sacred, because that would force us to also segue into PETA, which also wants to protect the life of a cow. And then we'd have to comment about how it's not just a cow. PETA even wants to protect the life of a fly. Where would it end? You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. You think you can run your new business without a website? Hello, McFly. How are they going to discover your business? The phone book? Do people even use that thing anymore? Or maybe you just leave your business card in restaurants next to the generous tip, but you won't be able to afford that generosity much longer if you don't start using the internet. I do understand. If you're anything like me, you entered the computer age kicking and screaming. After all, I'm the artist type. That's a fancy way of saying that the only time I fix a computer myself is by rebooting or remembering to plug it in. But I'll tell you, even though I'm more into the arts than the sciences, I use my computer constantly, all day long, in fact, and I couldn't even imagine getting by without my website. Let me tell you how to build a website of your own simply and easily without the cost and trouble of a designer. The name is Web Studio. I don't see you writing this down. Web Studio. Web Studio is a website design software. It enables you to create your own pages in minutes without knowing HTML. All you do is use your mouse to drag and drop images and text. Then it saves the pages for you on the internet. Sounds simple? The program includes 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and anything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. And don't worry, you can still use that sharp-looking business card. Just print your website on it. And welcome. Welcome to the 21st century. Did you know we've been to the moon? This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. This is your host, Bob Siegel. I am so honored to introduce my guest this afternoon, Davida Vlanderplug, manager of newsroom operations at KUSI News and five-time Emmy Award winner. Nobody in San Diego can forget the horrible fires from October of 2007. Well, sometimes, once in a while, good things actually come out of bad things, because that same week, Davida began with KUSI News. The fires have since vanished, thankfully, but Davida remained at KUSI and also remained a vital part of their newsroom. Davida, welcome to our program.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
You know, I've got to tell you, after having met you just that one time when I was down at KUSI, your resume is so impressive. You look too young to have done all the incredible things that you've done.
Well, you know what? It's nice to hear that. When I look in the mirror, I see the years.
Oh, I find that hard to believe. I'll bet you get carded everywhere you go.
I love it.
Well, listen, I'm telling you, I just went over your resume in preparing for the show yesterday. I don't think our own ambassador to France has done as many things as you have done.
It's called creative writing.
Well, you are an amazing person. Well, let's go back over some of the things you've done before, because what a journey even before getting to KUSI. Now, long before going into journalism, you were recruited by the FBI for your computer skills. How on earth did that come about?
Right out of high school, before the microchip, you know, the old COBOL flow charting. I grew up in a small town. Well, not that small. It's a military town, Norfolk, Virginia. And they had an opportunity for kids back then to go into vocational training, and I selected a high school that had vocational training. And I learned how to write programs in flow charting in the old computer language of COBOL. And at the time, the FBI was looking for young people, and they recruited me out of high school. And I moved to Washington, D.C. at the tender age of 16 and started working.
Are there any FBI stories you can tell us, or
none
is it
that
anything? Would you
really
have to kill
tell.
Me afterwards?
You know, we just coded things, and we didn't know what we were coding, but there were a few things that I found out later, but at the time I didn't know. I just kind of sat at a terminal and did what I did.
Anything later that you can share?
You know, I'd rather not.
Okay.
The Patty Hearst case was going on back then. I can tell you that some of it had a little to do with that.
Oh, very interesting. Now, after the FBI, you found yourself at the JFK Center for the Performing Arts.
Yeah, you know, I put in about a year and a half, almost 2 years with the FBI, and got the creative bug and decided I wanted to dance and do theater and, you know, wanted to get into the creative arts. So I tried my hand with a couple of dance troupes in Washington and eventually left the FBI and moved over with some of those administrative skills to work for the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. And I was one of the payroll officers for the Opera House, you know, one of the venues there under the umbrella. And I worked there for a little bit and tried to get into theater, you know, tried to go into show business, I guess is what you would call it.
And so did you make it into any Broadway shows?
I did not. I really did not.
But you did get some work as a model around that same time.
I did modeling work. I took the train up and down the Eastern Seaboard, back and forth between D.C. and New York, and eventually went to New York, moved to New York, and landed a couple of positions at ABC Television.
Yes, yeah, so you worked for Barbara Feischl and Agnes Nixon.
And Agnes Nixon. She was the ABC television complement to Agnes Nixon, the creator of the daytime soaps as we know them, All My Kids.
And boy, soaps are still just as popular as ever.
It was a big time. It was a big time. Yeah.
You know, you must have interesting feelings about reality shows, because I remember, Davita, years ago, people that I read in the newspaper that there were some people who follow those soap operas so religiously that they actually think those people exist. And I thought, boy, that's just nuts. And yet now it seems that so many of our reality shows actually are real live soap operas where the people do really exist.
You know what? Truth stranger than fiction.
It is. Although sometimes on the reality shows, we catch them acting more than the soap opera people, and the soap opera people do it better. But that is interesting. Now, how does one go from soap operas to journalism?
Well, here's what happened. I was at ABC, and I wanted to start my way into a college classroom. So I went to see my, you know, superiors there at the network and said, I'd like to go to a community college. I'd like to go to school. And they had a tuition refund program. And I got involved in all of that. And I went to Pace University for a little bit and decided I truly needed to pull back, and get my degree. So I ended up going home to Virginia and enrolled at what at the time was Hampton Institute.
Yeah, now you met some actors that later on worked as stars on the Spike Lee films.
Oh, yeah.
So, boy, even though you didn't go make it on Broadway, it sounds like you did something pretty similar,
or
every bit as prestigious, at least.
Some of the folks in Spike Lee's earlier films came out of the university centers in Virginia and down in Atlanta. And I did small productions with them at the college level, and they were all big stars now.
Well, and he's a phenomenal director.
Absolutely.
Have you ever met Spike Lee personally?
No, I haven't.
Well, he does some phenomenal
He's
films.
Amazing.
And you also did some playwriting around this time?
I did some playwriting. Nothing that I'd want to yell out over the airwaves. But the writing bug did hit me pretty strongly there. So when I enrolled at Hampton University, I enrolled in the Mass Media Arts Department after taking a run at theater and just really found my way, sort of found my voice, my writing voice there at the university. And that's where the bug hit.
Well, we can tell that Davita's at KUSI right now because you can hear all the hustle and bustle behind her.
I'm trying to find a quiet corner.
No, that's okay. It just isn't much.
You hear scanners, you hear keyboards.
It adds to the atmosphere. We hear you just fine, but it is interesting. You can just kind of hear the hustle and bustle of media right now. Now, playwriting is so different from journalism writing. Did you find it difficult to make that transition? You say the journalism bug bit you. Did you find you liked that better than writing fiction?
I did like the idea of writing stories and telling stories. And the accuracy of the story, of course, goes without saying right now in this conversation. But when you're trying to communicate what's going on around the general public, if you can find a voice that is a storytelling voice, it helps to communicate that idea, that message, that information to them clearer. And that act of communication is completed, I think, in a better form. So I didn't have a difficult transition. Not at all. I think it actually enhanced my writing capacity as I started to learn.
You seem like such a Renaissance woman. I doubt that you would have trouble transitioning to anything. All right, just tell our audience, name one or two things you don't do well, because I've looked over this resume. I sure can't find anything.
Oh, my goodness. I am afraid of the camera. Even this radio interview is a bit troubling for me, so I am definitely a behind-the-scenes person.
Now, that's interesting, because you obviously weren't as shy about getting up on a live stage, but there's something about it being a camera or being over the air?
You know, I think for me, and that I have so much respect for the people who do the in-front-of-the-camera work, you know, because people see you before they actually hear the message, and I think I just didn't want to focus so much on myself. You know, what's my hair doing? What do I look like? You know, and that's a part of it. It shouldn't be a big part of it, but the reality is that it is a part of it. So finding the information and doing the news gathering part of it and putting it together and giving it perspective and adding as much depth as possible, the researching and the writing was what I loved the most.
So when it's something fictitious, when you're in a play or you're modeling, and I understand you sing too, it's a little bit different because you can be portraying somebody else. But with journalism, you don't want the hard news and the purity of the news to cause any kind of distraction.
You really don't. And I'm looking for the words to describe the difference between standing on stage in a musical and singing. You know there are people there, but you're in a character or you're in a song or a lyric has you captivated, and you know, you sort of transcend the people. But when you are doing, when you're writing and you are reporting and you're trying to transmit vital information, as we do here in television news, then there is a specific person and group of people and audience and community that you're trying to connect with, and it is more direct.
Yeah, and you know,
and
when
the responsibility is different and greater.
Yeah, when you're doing theater too, you're aware of the audience. I've done a lot of theater and a lot of public speaking, and the transition to radio was difficult for me because I'm sitting here in this little room in front of a microphone, and probably far more people are hearing me, but you don't have any awareness of it. You're not getting any feedback with an audience. You just can almost feed off of their energy, and if they like you, you sense it right away.
And for the entertainment, beyond giving them an enjoyable experience and taking them somewhere, and a lot of times it's not to a real place, that difference takes a little pressure off. But when you are communicating, putting words to page or putting words into the computer or wherever they go these days with the new technology, into the mind and voice of an anchor, there's a responsibility there that you can't take lightly.
Now, what was your first job after your journalism degree? You got a master's in broadcast regulation, telecommunications, and law from Ohio, Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University.
That's correct. And, you know, I wasn't very smart about the market sizes and how you move up and cut your eye teeth in this business. So I packed up everything after my master's classwork, after the classroom work, before I actually did wrote the dissertation and the thesis. Before I did any writing, I just sort of packed up and moved down to Atlanta, Georgia, and went to work in radio.
Now, I understand you're responsible even for being at least one of the people who discovered Ryan Seacrest. He was on the radio, and you brought him to the attention of the television industry.
So that came many, many years later when I made it to Los Angeles and to KCAL Los Angeles. At the time, KCAL was not owned by CBS at the time, but we brought in a number of radio personalities to do television simulcasts and television appearances, and a lot of those radio personalities are now, you know, really, really big stars, and Ryan is just one of them.
He has an interesting role, doesn't he, on American Idol? He's kind
amazing.
Of the nice guy to get help people recover from Simon.
He's amazing.
Do you enjoy watching American Idol?
I watched the first couple of seasons, but I'm not an avid watcher right now. I work the morning show. My goodness, I'm up at 2:30.
That's right. You probably have to turn in around, what, 6 or probably 6?
I have to catch things on the web.
Yeah,
after
yeah.
Fact.
Well, it's an interesting show. I have to admit, I love hearing Simon tell people that they stink, but then he's so cruel, I feel guilty for laughing. Not real guilty, but
Simon Radio gave me a big respect for people who do what you do.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. Now, you also worked for a while at CNN Headline News, but you missed local news. Now, I find that very interesting because I'm around a lot of news people, and they're the ones that love the local news and they're ones that love national. How does one go from national news to local news? You're so talented. I bet you could have stayed at CNN as long as you wanted, and yet it was the local news that was interesting you more than the national.
You know, I think everybody has a different love when they're crafting and producing and putting together stories and programs and programming half hours and hours. What I found different about the experience at the network level was I didn't have enough contact with the actual raw materials that created the story. It's a big operation, and it runs like a fine-tuned machine, and each person's role is defined and so clearly defined that the lines, for me, just for me, were a bit prohibitive, I felt, and I wanted to stretch out and have more contact with that community, and the national audience is a huge blanket of communities. So the local agenda just suited my journalistic needs a little more. So I want it back to local news as soon as I can get it. And I had the opportunity to work at KCAL, and it was, you know, not a network operation. It was, you know, independent, which means it gave you the freedom to, if something happened, if there was a storm, unexpected storm, you could blow out an hour or so of your programming and just go in there and give people what they needed. And the network game is a little different.
Yeah, I'll bet that there's just far more committees on the network, and probably at times the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. So you feel there's a little more ownership of a story from start to finish when
Absolutely.
You're working locally.
You know, here at KUSI, you can take the call from a viewer, take an email from a viewer that actually invites you into his or her community, and they're sharing with you, this is happening in my backyard, and, you know, we want to get this word out. Can you help us? And it just sort of reminds us of the genesis of what we do, which is to satisfy those needs and be there for them.
Now, you joined KUSI as news operations manager, and then just 6 months or so later, you became executive producer of Good Morning San Diego.
Acting.
Acting, executive.
Acting. You know, there was a bit of a void, and I volunteered to do whatever I could, whatever skills I had, to try and bring them to the table. This operation is just amazing in what we do for this community, and the community recognizes that whenever something of significance happens. We can see how they turn to us and they tune into us. They trust us to tell them the straight story and to get them where they need to go and provide whatever they need. You know, we know that whenever the fires break out, people tune in droves to this television station because they know these are the local guys. They care about us.
That's true. There probably is a better relationship between the audience and the local news.
Absolutely.
Now,
that's where you turn, and you have, well, you know this, you can get 200 channels. But if something is happening next door, you want to tune into the channel that actually has a camera or a person or a voice or an eye.
That's right. You know, I was only on the local channels when those fires hit. That's
absolutely
right.
That's where you want to go. And I think I remember when I watched the fire coverage, and having seen some pretty big operations, I was so impressed with to what degree this television station, KUSI, went to make sure that everyone, no matter where they were living, no matter how remote, got as much information in as quickly and accurately as possible.
Now, obviously, you're not simply the acting operations manager anymore. You're one of the producers of Good Morning San Diego?
Well, I get up, I walk in, and I put in my time and try to do the best I can. The position is manager of newsroom operations, and the goal is to try and do both well.
So does that go beyond the Good Morning San Diego program, or are you in charge of some other things too?
You know, a locally run television station means the bosses walk down and they say, we need you to, put
could
your
be,
finger right there and hold it there for 5 minutes.
Could be anything. Could be
My
anything.
My finger would be there. Absolutely.
Now, what has been your most memorable moment at KUSI and all the time you've been working there?
It was the fires. Absolutely. I had taken my daughter up to Los Angeles or to see, Not Scary Farm, and the fires broke out. She lost my cell phone. I'm driving back on the 5, and I'm seeing smoke, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I've only been at this job a couple of weeks. What is going on? I've got to get in. You know, when something is breaking, it just makes you feel like you need to be in the television station, and I was on the road. And I walked in, and I saw a group of dedicated journalists and support people in this television station from every department, all hands on deck. And it was just amazing. And I was really, really proud to have signed on for a tour of duty with the television station that day. And we were in this newsroom for 13 and 14 hours straight. I know that I was on that day, and others for even longer. And I was so impressed. And knew right then I'd made a good decision to come here.
That must have been quite an experience to be driving and hearing this on the news about the fires, and then you don't have a cell phone. You must have just been climbing the walls of that car.
And my poor daughter, I don't know what she thought. Mom, I'm so sorry I lost the phone. But, I just drove straight to the station. I dropped her off and kept moving.
Well, it sounds like you have an adorable daughter. Now, I understand, in addition to everything else, you sing in your spare time.
I do. There isn't a piano bar that wouldn't know my name in and around San Diego.
Do you have anything coming up in the near future?
No. And that's the piano minus the bar, just for the record here.
Okay. Have you ever made any CDs or anything like that?
I have. I haven't distributed any.
Well, you know what? The next time you're on my show, we might just have to play one of your songs,
to play.
Too.
Okay. All right. I'm open to that.
Okay. Well, we would love to hear that. Now, I know that because you're into the, we have in journalism the the editorial side of the news and the hard news, which is where you're at. So I know you're not allowed to let your opinions be known about the issues, and there's so many going on. Do you ever find that when you're out with friends that you have to just bite your lips because they'll say things? Or are there some people that you can trust and let them know your opinion on things?
My husband.
Your husband, okay.
My father. You know, I think it's safe, you know, and we're in a politically charged environment right now, but I do think it's safe to say that as a journalist, your personal persuasion, political persuasion, should not enter into the equation at all.
Do you feel that gets kind of blurred in places today? I have no problem with somebody saying, I do a news analysis show, I do an editorial, I certainly offer my opinions over the radio, but it's understood that I'm going to do that. But when you have somebody who's supposed to be an anchor or supposed to be a reporter, and they're not claiming to do editorials, do you find that too often they're doing it anyway?
I think the line, when it is allowed to blur, so to speak, it does jeopardize the journalistic integrity of the television station. But I do think that there are television operations that can have commentary and have straight news, and they can coexist under the same roof, and everything's fine. I just, as a journalist, want, at least in my world, whatever I'm responsible for, that the accountability on both sides of the camera be held. So if we're interviewing a newsmaker who happens to be a politician, he or she is to be held accountable for the office. And he or she is to be held accountable for the public aspect of that office. And the journalistic camera and microphone and quill, if you will, has to take on that same responsibility and accountability. And we all know what we're responsible for doing, and as long as we stay within those parameters and not veer, you know, you're human, not veer too far off course in any direction, that it's a safe, and I think that's the design, to keep everything in check and keep everything balanced.
We have to ask those tough questions, but we've got to be just as willing to ask the tough questions of somebody with a different point of view at the same time.
Absolutely.
Well, I really admire your ability to do that, because I am so opinionated, and you sound like such a sharp person, and you obviously are, so it's not like you don't have opinions, and that is showing really remarkable self-control. You're out with your friends, somebody makes some comment, and you must just have to bite your lips, especially if you feel they don't know what they're talking about, and you could educate them, and I admire your ability to keep that inside.
You know, even your closest friends will try and bait you, you know, into getting involved in a conversation. But, you know, you have your personal time, you have your personal world, and you have to know who's in it and be very careful.
Well, not just your personal friends, your relatives around the Thanksgiving dinner table will try to do it as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Davida, what an honor to talk to you. I hope you'll come on our program again and bring one of your songs next time.
I will. I absolutely will. Thank you for inviting me.
It was my pleasure. Davida van der Ploeg of KUSI News. We will be right back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
How many times have you heard the phrase, they're all the same, applied to local contractors? It is unfortunate that a few can tarnish the reputations of many, but it sure is nice when you find a contractor with godly principles. But what if they only do floors or only the painting? What if you want to build a whole new home? Or you want someone to fully complete your remodel or tenant improvements? You need ProBuilt. Serving San Diego since 1987, residential and commercial, quality work, completed on time. Local Christian businessman and president of ProBuilt, Jim Bell, said, when people pay you to do a job, they simply want you to do the job. They expect quality work, and they expect it to be done on time. We do that at ProBuilt. For references and dozens of pictures of both residential and commercial work, visit our website, ProBuiltInc.com. That's ProBuiltInc.com. Or call our El Cajon office at 619-593-2965. We're fully bonded and insured. California State License Number 567925. ProBuilt.
back to the Bob Siegel Show. Well, big in the news this week, Evan Bayh, the senator from Indiana, has announced that he will not seek re-election. His stated position? Big surprise. There's not enough bipartisanship in Washington. No bipartisanship? That just brought a tear to my eye. Bipartisanship, as you know, has become the new explanation for everything. When Republicans took back the House and the Senate 2 years into Clinton's presidency, Democratic pundits rushed to go on television with other talking heads on the panels, and they claimed this meant that the people wanted bipartisanship. Couldn't possibly have meant that they wanted the Democrats out of office. However, when the Democrats took back Congress in 2006 during the George Bush administration, their immediate explanation was that the people had spoken, meaning, of course, that most Americans wanted Republicans out of office. And just this year, when Scott Brown won a landslide election in the liberal state of Massachusetts, campaigning on a promise of lower taxes and no government-run health care, the Democratic interpretation, once again, was that the American people wanted bipartisanship. Now, supposedly, Evan Bayh is stepping down for the same reason. Folks, call me a romantic, but there may just be another reason. Polls, recent elections, tea parties, reasons like that, town hall meetings, which indicate that many Democratic congressmen and senators will lose their seats this November. Bayh's personal numbers are starting, just starting, to suggest the same thing. Although previously promising, a recent poll showed him 3 points behind Mike Pence in a hypothetical contest. Now, it was only hypothetical. Pence is not running, but that could serve as a possible glimpse of what might come from conservatives who have not yet entered the race. Maybe this guy who eventually went along with Obama's health care proposal, despite the fact that Republican ideas were completely ignored, is not interested in bipartisanship nearly as much as he claims. Perhaps he's just good at reading the handwriting on the wall and wants to get out. Well, the getting is good. After all, it always looks better when a man resigns instead of waiting to get fired. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Now, I'm about to comment on something very sacred to my many Christian brothers and sisters. That sacred topic, worship services, church worship services, or sometimes retreat worship services, sometimes campus fellowship, but worship services. Now, I know this is a delicate subject, so let me begin with an important disclaimer. Boy, I do a lot of disclaimers on this show, don't I? I even have my own little friend, Disclaimer Dan, who comes on and helps me once in a while. This time, I'll handle it myself. My disclaimer, I do enjoy singing worship songs. Okay? Honestly, I do. Now, some of you are going to find that hard to believe when you're done listening to this humble little discourse, because it may give you an emotional reaction. And sometimes emotions cause us to hear things that were not actually said. But it's true. I love church worship, and I especially love current church worship. I'm glad contemporary bands have replaced the roller rink-style sounds of organ hymns in many of today's evangelical churches. Unfortunately, this energized vitality has also created a new practice. It's like that old saying, you can't have the turkey without the stuffing. While we Protestants pat ourselves on the back, congratulating each other for the abandonment of meaningless Catholic ritual or old-fashioned 1800s Protestant tradition, we may want to pause for a moment and examine a few sacraments of our own. Now, before continuing, please know that I am not singling out any one church. Not at all. As a matter of fact, because I am an itinerant speaker, I've visited countless churches and parachurch fellowships for over 3 decades and across the whole country. And yet, no matter how many new doors I step through, I seem to hear the exact same lecture inside. No, I don't mean the pastor's sermon. I mean the worship leader's sermon. That's right. Often you hear two sermons. Is this starting to sound familiar? You've experienced this. I've experienced this. We're in the middle of a worship service. The band's up there. We're in the audience. We're singing. Suddenly, the worship leader stops us faster than a plug to be yanked off the wall. He says, hey, folks, Are you really worshiping or are you going to sleep out there? Come on. Some of you look like wax statues. In all fairness, the description wax statues is not always used. Sometimes the congregation members are referred to as zombies. Sometimes they're referred to as corpses. After a little bit of uncomfortable laughter from the audience, people are reminded that they are not in church to merely sing. Indeed, folks, we are here to worship, and not just worship, true worship, real worship, authentic worship, heartfelt worship. Are you worshiping? I mean, are you really worshiping? Really and truly? If so, why that sad, melancholy look on your face? And how come some of you are still sitting down? You should be standing and clapping. You should feel the freedom to lift up your hands in praise. Okay, that sounds real spiritual. Christians are just great at sounding spiritual, but spiritual as it's supposed to sound, the experience is not unlike many of the secular shows or concerts or pep rallies you've been to so many times in life where some enthusiastic host lets you know in a not too subtle way that you aren't getting excited enough. How are you tonight? You ever heard that? There's some rally or something's about to start. MC gets up there, shouts from the center stage, "How are you tonight?" Some people clap. Others say, "Fine." Great. Doesn't matter. Whatever they say, the MC responds with, "Whoa, ho, ho, ho. Let's try that again. I said, how are you tonight?" And at that point, the audience shouts and claps even louder, hopefully so the guy will just leave them alone. And then the MC says, "That's better." Now, I got to be honest with you. I suspect this character was going to put us through this routine no matter what the reaction. He planned it out ahead of time. If the audience stood on its head after hearing the words, "How are you tonight?" the MC was still planning to say, "Whoa, ho, ho, ho. Come now, we can do better than this." All right, now who are we kidding? Today's worship experience is not much different. Neither does the patronizing lecture become legitimized merely because somebody reminded us about worshiping God. Those who talk about the Holy Spirit would be insulted by a suggestion that they may actually be as legalistic as the Pharisees. That's because none of us ever see our own legalism as legalism. To us, it's keenly spiritual. So spiritual, we wish everybody could walk with God as we do. Yes, the behavior or practice is always spiritual when we do it. Legalism is something everybody else struggles with. It might interest you to know that the first century church was also filled with people who judged the spirituality of others. No, they were not arguing as much about music in those days. But they judged each other on the practice of holy days, what foods to eat, what foods to not eat, a whole plethora of other spiritually motivated concerns. I mean, no disrespect for those of you who love worship. Maybe you sincerely care about the people around you, and you merely wish they could get as much out of the singing time as you. Your heart is probably in the right place. When we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you where your head is, though, while your heart is in the right place. This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
We're talking about worship. More specifically, we're talking about Christians judging other Christians for the way they worship. for their posture. Are they lifting up their hands? Are they not lifting up their hands? And I said before I went to the break that I know your heart is probably in the right place. I know you may just sincerely care about the people. You may just want to hope that they get as much out of the singing time as you. All right, that's very, very nice of you. I mean that sincerely. All I ask is that you remember a couple of things. First, music is a matter of taste. Of taste. We all like different kinds of music. That's why it correlates so strongly with our feelings and our emotions. Not everybody enjoys the same song to an equal degree, even when the song is about Jesus. If you don't like the song, it doesn't mean you don't like Jesus. If I hear a tune I do not care for, I'm not quite as excited. I mean, I could pretend I am. I can still appreciate the fact that others enjoy the music. I can still have a worshipful attitude. Number two, even when somebody likes a particular piece of music, that person will respond with his or her own personality. Some people are just quieter by nature. They don't always feel like jumping up and down. They may even love the song. Such love does not automatically translate into clapping or dancing. Why exactly should this be considered a problem? Now you think about Bob, maybe those who sit still are not truly worshiping. You might be right. You might be right. Maybe they're not. Maybe they're not truly worshiping. Then again, maybe they are. How do you know? Because of the look on their face, because of their posture, do you have the ability to look inside another person's heart? What should our response be to things like this? Paul actually told us long ago in the book of Romans, chapter 15, verse 8, he said, "Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he stands or falls." Let me read that again. Romans 15:8, the Apostle Paul talking when Christians judge the spirituality of others. Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Yes, we have a right to speak the gospel and its truth and its clarity. If somebody says they don't believe in Jesus, we say, well, you believe what you want. Jesus is still true. Jesus still commands me to preach this gospel. But once a person has accepted Christ, once they become a Christian, how they worship God is their own business. Yeah, but Bob, maybe worship leaders just want people to feel a special freedom to let go of any inhibitions. Some are intimidated when challenged to lift up their hands, but they should feel free to do so and not be looking around to see who's watching them. Okay, free to do so, free to lift up our hands, free to dance. Sounds great. I love freedom. Only one question, just a little question. Doesn't freedom to do something include freedom to not do something? I remember a number of years ago, a Christian friend from the Philippines was over here as a foreign exchange student, was going to my campus church out at UCSD, where we had some very enthusiastic worship leaders that were always talking about posture during worship. And they said the same thing. You should be free to dance. You should be free to lift up your hands. And I remember asking my friend about this. He said something very profound. He said, "In my home country, we are free to vote, but we aren't free not to vote." That's what these worship leaders were reminding him of. But Bob, if the same Holy Spirit is really leading us during worship, shouldn't we all be worshiping the same way? People, worship is a voluntary response to God. God made us each different for a reason. Maybe he does not need to see identical posture while looking across the aisle. Maybe God is more interested in enjoying our worship than commanding choreographed music. I'm not saying the Holy Spirit won't choose to inspire us here and there while we sing. He can do whatever he wants. He's God. But even so, if we really desire the Holy Spirit's leading, why don't we get out of the way and let him? Far too often, we do not observe the Holy Spirit pushing the direction of worship. Instead, we hear the worship leader sharing those stern, fatherly exhortations. You can reach us by phone at 888-344-1170. You can also reach us over the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. Mike from Champaign, Illinois says, regarding my comments about Evan Bai, he said, "Bai made an interesting comment yesterday. When asked what he'd do, he said perhaps start a business which might create a job, which is more than the whole stimulus package has done. I'm not a big Bai fan, but as close as we are to Indiana, pick up stuff on him. He's not been as bad as most of the Democrats, but he held rank with them and is going down with them." Larry in Spring Valley says he agrees with my comments about people not judging each other during worship, or he agrees that they shouldn't be doing that. He's observed similar judgment. He says, and I won't mention his church, but he says, as a choir member who enjoys worshiping God during the service and who loves to inspire others in the congregation to do so, I often wonder, what's the point when the drums completely drown us out so that I can't even hear myself singing? My experience is that the phenomena you described, audience made to feel self-conscious, which seems the opposite of focusing on God or in spiritual by the worship leader, surprisingly happens more often in the allegedly freer atmosphere of charismatic congregations than in more traditional church services. Often when I'm at a charismatic worship service, which my wife has come to crave, I feel pressure to behave freer, which actually decreases my sense of worship due to increased self-awareness. Your message needed to be said, well done. Who's really leading the worship? In this respect, I wish we'd sing lots of traditional hymns, which actually taught us more about God's character and nature than what my uncle refers to as 7-11 songs, meaning seven words repeated 11 times. Well, Larry, I bet I know what some of those words are. The word praise, the word glory, the word honor, maybe the word hands, since we sing more about what we're doing with our hands than about God. However, and I don't want to make the same mistake. I don't want to start judging the way someone else. If you want to sing about your posture, I think God just looks at your heart. You can sing whatever you want. You can sing whatever lyrics you want. You can sing to whatever tune you want, but it's got to work both ways. I like the lyrics to some of those hymns, too. I don't care for the tunes of most hymns, except for Be Thou My Vision. That is a beautiful one. Amazing Grace, I guess. Who couldn't like Amazing Grace? But even in some of those hymns, boy, years ago, somebody discovered that the word soul rhymed with whole. He saved my soul. He made me whole. If somebody hadn't discovered that rhyme, half our hymns would not have been written. Mark in El Cajon says, and he has a question here, a Bible question. Here we are as mankind, and what exactly as a human race have we learned after all these years? We still do the same things. In other words, we love, we kill, we steal, we invent. We basically are the same people as those people thousands of years ago. By the way, there are no new emotions being invented. So we, us today, that is, are the same people as we are in year 1 or 44 BC when Julius Caesar was assassinated, or even further back in history for that matter. So with that being said, yes, I agree that a particular individual is learning a particular lesson of life's experience for the first time. Mark's referring to a question that I answered from somebody else last week, where a woman named Diana asked us why human beings go through the same lessons all the time. And I said that for each of us as individuals, we only go through that lesson once. Historically, people certainly go through those lessons again. So Mark's responding to my answer to Diana's question. He says, my experiences as Mark Taylor are unique to me, but I know that someone somewhere currently now or in the past has experienced my lessons, not exactly like mine, of course, but very, very close to mine. So why does God keep perpetuating the same thing over and over again? If we count and add up all the people that have lived since the dawn of time, and for argument's sake, let's say that is 40 billion people, so God has that many to look at and see before some are sent to hell, just how many are now good people or bad people? So many instances of the same emotions are being played out in so many different situations, but then again, the same. My experiences were one way. John Doe's, who was born 20 years earlier to myself, was just a little bit different, but still very close to me. A woman born in the 18th century somewhere on earth had certain experiences. My wife experienced these things very, very similarly and handled it in a very similar way to the 18th century woman. So with 40 billion people since the dawn of time and only a limited number of emotions, I say it can safely be assumed that the experiences of all those 40 billion people are bound to repeat and or overlap themselves. So with so many examples for God to view, why keep perpetuating the same thing over and over and over again with new human beings, new generations, etc.? It's like we're all in a revolving door going around in circles, experiencing basically the same emotions over and over again through the ages of time. Mark continues with his letter. I'm sure you saw the movie with Bill Murray, Groundhog Day. I did see that movie, Mark, and I absolutely loved it. Groundhog Day, where the poor chap was literally doomed to experience the same day over and over again. That's the way I sometimes view us here on Earth. Don't get me wrong. I believe in a higher supreme being. But am I to be condemned for having a God-given, free-thinking, analytical mind? Well, in the 1 or 2 seconds I have left, Mark, God likes the fact that you have an analytical mind, and there's nothing wrong with that. For myself, I can only say that I have to keep learning the same lesson because of my sin and not being interested to turn from my sin. But to God, it's not an experiment. God is completely removed from time, and he sees it happening all at once. And you'll see me next Sunday at 3.
Thank you for listening to The Bob Siegel Show. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. The Bob Siegel Show was brought to you in part by the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton, helping infertile families have children. Tom Pinkerton would like to invite you to help Bob expand his radio program by donations or sponsorship. For more information about Bob's ministry, go to www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you can read Bob's articles and get information about Bob's books. That's Bob Siegel, SIEGEL.net.